translate messages.
Well, I suppose the point is we're all flying the plane.
There's Graham.
Hello, Graham. How are things in Devon?
This place.
Good to see you. Martin, good afternoon.
Oh, yeah.
Well, I'll be seeing some of you later on this evening as well. Because we have an interesting schedule this evening as well. Sorry, I actually have my the psychology of success, boys and girls online later on this evening. The excitement of it all.
Hi, Billy. Hi, everyone. Sorry if I ignored you earlier. You're on the headphone.
Hello, Graham. How are you?
Very well, thank you.
Greetings.
Hi.
Ronan, I need to say hello to this man because it is a long, long time since I've actually spoken to you, Ronan. And it's great to see you.
Hi, Willie, how are you?
I know you were online the last time as well, but you were lurking in the shadows very quietly. How are you?
I'm very good, thank you. Very good indeed.
Excellent. Excellent.
Not doing as much as I want to do type of thing. So it's not in any way stressful. And no, I find your weekly videos great. And it's great to stay in touch, as you say.
Good to see you. Although I think that's your Pinterest photograph, Ronan, is it?
It's a few years old at this stage, really. I haven't had a haircut recently.
All right. Yeah, you and me both.
You're looking great. Anyway, good to see you.
Oh, well, thanks, Ronan. The great thing is about these. I was going to say hairbands. This headset is it actually acts as a hairband.
Well, it does rather.
Yeah.
Are you still in touch with Deloitte at all?
Not really. No, I don't okay. really. I don't really talk with
Orla was there.
That many. Oh, well, Orla's moved on.
Oh, I didn't know that. Okay.
Oh yeah, Orla is in Davies. At least she was.
I see. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's all very quiet. I haven't been in Dublin for a couple of years either.
Well, indeed.
Well, for obvious reasons over the last year, but I haven't really been in Dublin at all for probably a good 2 years at this stage. The best 2 years.
Well, maybe we'll be able to travel again soon, we'll see.
Oh, well, there's not much we can do about that, and yet people are tying themselves in knots, annoying themselves about it.
Whereas, anyway, I'll let you get on with your main forum. Good to talk to you.
Well, we don't know what the main forum is about. Isn't that right, Dennis? That's the joy of this living in the moment.
We're flowing.
Liz, welcome, good afternoon. Liz. Very good to see you. Very good to see you. And Brian, very good to see you as well. And Shelley.
Hello, Willie. How you doing?
That is Shelley, isn't it? I'm as blind as a bat. Do you know that? Yes, it is Shelley. Yeah. I'm good. We're all good. The interesting thing is that I said at the end of the last conversation that I would pick up on some of the things that were in the chat the last time. And then I went and corrupted the little text file that is the chat that went with it. So I have no idea what the questions were the last time. Dennis, you're going to keep your eye on chat this afternoon. Well, sorry, that's not fair to you either. I mean, the only reason you'd be keeping your eyes on chat is that I can't see without my glasses. And if I put them on now, I wouldn't be able to see all the beautiful people either, including Pat O'Donnell. Now, there's a...
Hey, Willie.
Good Lord. How are you? Good to see you.
Good.
Dennis, I don't know what you had in mind or if you had anything in mind. Certainly, I didn't really have very much in mind when I came up and sat down here this afternoon. But I was just ruminating on the whole notion of conscious conversations at all. And it might be no harm if we thought about the alternative, because the alternative is unconscious conversations. And the terrible thing about life in general and the life, the people that we encounter in everyday life is that they're unconscious, they're dead from the neck up, and they expect everything to swim along beautifully, and they expect to bring about changes in their lives whilst actually being dead to the world. Sorry, there's no point in putting too fine a tooth in it. Therefore, when we actually start thinking or reflecting, I'll tie myself in knots, reflecting on the whole idea of conscious conversations, we realize, or certainly I realize, that even in walking up the stairs to do this, I had a choice to make, Would I walk up the stairs, run up the stairs? Would I walk up the stairs mindfully? Would I feel my feet coming up the stairs? Would I rush into the room out of breath? Or would I actually come up here about 20 minutes ahead of schedule and just sit here and breathe for a few minutes? We have these choices to make all of the time. And the problem is that when we don't make it, these conscious decisions, we set ourselves off in a direction where anything could happen. But unfortunately, the anything that could happen might be bad rather than good, or reactive rather than proper, if I can put it like that. I don't know if that is a ball with which to get the conversation rolling.
Yeah, well, I also like to use the analogy of kind of, we walk around either kind of asleep in our dream of reality or what we go through every day, or maybe another way of putting it is we're in the default or the autopilot mode. Mm. You know, we're not, are we really flying our plane? If our plane is who we are, or if we put it in autopilot and, you know, gets back to not being so conscious in the way we think, you know, we relate to people and engage with our with the world around us. So,
well, it, you know, if you wake up in the morning and you do nothing about it, the autopilot comes on by default. Once the autopilot is engaged, you're disengaged from everything else, because an autopilot, your autopilot, my autopilot, needs programs on which to run. Every autopilot, that's how a plane will get you from Denver, well, back to Denver, as it turned out a couple of days ago. That's how a plane will get you from Denver to Honolulu or wherever. And if we're on default, and if the autopilot is engaged, the autopilot's going to use its programs. The programs are the same. Neural Lab in UCLA confirms that. Day in, day out. So the autopilot will always bring you back to the same place. So it's actually worse than not being engaged. It is so soul-destroying to end up in the same place every day, particularly when you might have started off the day with the best of intentions. Or even started off a meeting with the best of intentions. Because, I mean, one of the things, Dennis, you do is, and I do to a lesser and lesser extent nowadays, but you work with corporations in terms of trying to get people to become more conscious, to develop a more conscious culture in the organization. So you might even go into a meeting with the best of intentions and lose the plot halfway through the meeting, which means the meeting will end up where you didn't want it to end up in the first place.
Yeah, it's interesting. Recently heard a presentation with some data from the Gallup organization that 65% of the workforce in corporations and companies report that they are unengaged in their work. That's 65%. So when I think about what we're talking about, you know, being more conscious to engage people, you have to be present. You have to listen. You have to allow people to speak up, ask questions. And so often these meetings, Willie, that you talk about, a leader may go into the meeting with a very structured agenda. I've got to get through this in 45 minutes. I've got my bullet points. I got my PowerPoint. Boom, boom, boom. There's no interaction. It's all one-way communication. It's not two-way communication. And there's no engagement. And then the leader does his employee engagement survey through Gallup or any other company,
yeah,
and gets feedback that his managers or her managers and employees aren't engaged. So,
and he or she wonders why.
And you know, you can take this home. You think about your wife, your husband, your significant other.
Don't think about my wife, Dennis. That's not none of your business.
I'm not thinking about you. But human relationships, whether they're at home or at work, have these basic dynamics of listening, communicating, you know, allowing that relationship to unfold in the present moment and not walk into it with a memorized speech and kind of a predetermined agenda, because typically if you do, you will be listening to your own story, and you're probably not, you're always listening what you're going to say next. You're not hearing what the other person is saying, right? I mean, Willie, I'm sure you observe that with your clients. We talk about being present, but I think this just gets back to...
Well, Dennis, you know, think about how we normally conduct a conversation, or in the old days when we conducted a conversation before we all became these wonderful, mindful beings. So I'm after biting my tongue, it was so firmly in my throat, in my cheek. People tend to have a conversation in which they're actively not involved, because they're not listening to what somebody is saying, because they're thinking about what they might say next, or they're thinking about whether they should think about what they think they should say next. In other words, people will often tie themselves in knots, wondering whether they should make a humorous remark or an intelligent intervention. And they wonder whether it would be seen as an intelligent intervention or not, or am I allowed to even make the intervention, or what will people think of me if I say that? And of course, as a result of all that, they're not at the meeting at all. They're not engaged in the conversation at all. The interesting thing, Dennis, is the accountant in me would say if 65% of people aren't engaged in my organization, I'm wasting an awful lot of my money paying people for what they're not doing. Sorry, that's the accountant in me. The other, and this is, by the way, a slight anecdote that Mr. O'Donnell in Westport will appreciate, because he knows the individual involved. I have worked from time to time with a particular team in a particular organization. And on one occasion, because they go to the leadership team goes off to these off-site strategic days with an agenda. And I actually suggested to the leader of the site on one occasion that he should have an agendaless meeting for a whole day, which according to some people on the team was wonderful. And according to himself was an absolute car crash. He nearly died at the idea of not going into a meeting with a PowerPoint presentation, or not going into a meeting with a structure where everybody would say their bit and then move on. And of course, because everybody has to say their bit in a meeting like that, nobody's listening to the bit that's being spoken about at the moment. They're worrying about their bit.
I'd like to ask our participants, you know, can you, do you resonate with anything that we're sharing, any thoughts or examples of your own experience?
I think if you turn Dennis's analogy on its head, I run a small company and we produce musical events. At the moment, I'm putting a team together for a new event, which will be rolled out after lockdown. So it's quite tentative at first, because you have to work out who's going to get on with who, who's going to complement whose skills and all this kind of stuff. When you get it right, the dynamics really sort of like kick off. But I had a Zoom call the other day with a bunch of people who are going to be in production roles, i.e. looking after money and sort of like looking to sort of hire a director, that kind of thing. And I sort of like rolled out my plan kind of thing. And then I asked for input, and there was kind of like quite a lot of silence. And it occurred to me that people were actually too scared to actually put forward their own ideas. Maybe because they've been criticized in the past, maybe because they thought they didn't know enough about the show. But gradually, and sort of like bit by bit, we managed to sort of like get people to sort of like ask questions, which were presumably they've been thinking on for some time. But to actually stimulate that kind of interaction is sometimes quite difficult, especially at first. But it all comes back to the same question. Are we actually in the moment? Are we actually sort of like doing what we have to do at the time? Or are we being programmed into what roles are assumed to be? It's quite nice being, you know, known as the big chief kind of thing, but It's not the way a musical production moves forward. It's the sum of everybody's input that is exciting, not just one person directing it.
Yeah.
I just wanted to add that there's one quote, I think it's Buddha, that says that you may be a great speaker, but you're only speaking about what you already know. Whereas if you become a great listener, you actually learn something new. And then going back to your plane analogy with the autopilot, you've got Einstein who said that, you know, the logical brain will take you from A to Z. Whereas if you're using the creative side of your brain, which is the imagination, it can take you anywhere. And I think that links in also to those who have set agendas for meetings. You know, you need to get through that list from A to Z. Then, you know, you've almost prescribed what you expect and anticipate the outcome to be. Whereas it almost, if you're going with no agenda and just a rough idea of a starting point, hopefully that will then open up to the, you know, the new ideas, the innovation. But going back to what Martin was saying as well, is that, yeah, a lot of people are what I would suggest as being, and I've been victim to this, whereby you feel that when there's a hierarchy, I'm not suggesting that you're doing this, Martin, but when there's a hierarchy clearly portrayed within a company or a system, it's almost like you feel it's not your place to contribute, or that your voice may not have a value. And yet when you go to like the Fortune 500 companies, they're not actually really interested in what training or experience per se that you've got. It's just what passion you've got with that particular company, because those with the passion that may not have had the opportunity to have had the certificates and degrees or whatever, they value those type of people as particularly being the innovators, the ones that will then be able to contribute the new ideas. But I think it's just going in gently and sort of like chipping away at establishing that ethos and that atmosphere whereby, you know, everyone is valued equally. And unfortunately, it is a slow process that just drip feeding the fact that everyone is valuable and, you know, please speak up. And even accepting something that, you know, you just think, well, where on earth did that idea come from? That, you know, that's not applicable. But not judging what's said, just let it come out. You know, it may be something that's not relevant at the time, but maybe relevant at another time, you just never know. So that's just what I wanted to add to that. Thank you.
One thing, a couple of things, but I read somewhere recently that a good leader, the defining a good leader is the guy who has the answers at the end of the meeting, not at the beginning of the meeting.
Excellent.
Which, you know, it's so simple. Like, it's just the guy goes into the meeting looking for information because the participants around the table have probably more knowledge than he has, each of them in different areas. And if he listens, he'll come out with the right answer, you know. My own experience going back to earlier part of the conversation, and I saw this at the very top level of organizations where there was a meeting where maybe you'd have 10 or 12 of the top level of the organization engaged in a meeting. There's one guy at the top, maybe doing a PowerPoint presentation. There's three of them on their phones, checking texts. And there's at least two or three with laptops open up, just reading the latest email, trying to keep on top of their jobs. And like, that's the leadership. And you know, what leaders do, others follow. And then you wonder why the organization or the employees are not engaged. I remember one time that in my own part of the organization, I insisted on a rule of topless meetings, which caused a bit of a stir, but it was just, I wouldn't allow a laptop at the meeting. You just couldn't have, you could have it there, but you couldn't have it open. But it was all about just trying to get people to focus on what we're trying to do. And you could spend hours discussing a subject But really, there's only one or two people in the room at the time. The rest of them are all off doing phones or looking out the window or on their emails or whatever. Tremendous waste of time by very intelligent people, of course, myself included.
Well, excluding yourself, Pat, apparently intelligent people.
Apparently intelligent people. Yeah, no, I'm now retired and I'm in a much better place and much more time for being mindful.
Yeah, you've made a very interesting point, and I think we touched on it the last time as well. Leaders, obviously, by definition, lead, and if you have a leader, you have, by definition, and it's called this. Much like the term, but it's called follower. Look, they're called followers in all the leadership theory. So if you have leadership, you have followership. And if you're a leader, and by the way, leader doesn't necessarily mean the big chief or right at the pinnacle hierarchically, because very often you'll find that there are leaders, champions, so to speak, sprinkled throughout an organization. But if you are a leader or you are looked up to by others as a leader, you're constantly being watched. And the people who are watching you very often don't even know they're constantly watching you. So everything you model, they copy. The old expression, monkey see, monkey do.
One of the award-winning Baldrige organizations over here in the U.S., I remember reading about their leadership decision to tear out the wall of their corporate office and just put glass in so that employees walking by could see at any given time what they were doing. So talk about being transparent and exposing themselves. They were very well aware that people watched what they did when they got to work, when they went home, and said, we're going to just literally tear down the walls and remove these barriers of secrecy and, some kind of a hidden agenda going on with the senior leadership here, and created these glass walls so they could be seen. So I don't propose you have to tear down walls and put up windows, but in a sense, I think that's what we do in our relationships. We have these walls, these defenses, these things we protect ourselves, our vulnerabilities. And another interesting thing actually in that Gallup survey was the number one reason for people leaving a company, number one reason was a dysfunctional relationship with their direct report, their manager, their supervisor. It wasn't their pay, it wasn't their hours, it was the fact that they did not have an effective relationship person to person with who they reported to. So again, to me, this gets back to engaging human beings, whether it's over Zoom or in person. I think we're all learning a new skill set of engagement through this virtual medium. But the importance of communicating, I think, is huge. Not just for a business bottom line, but just for effective relationships in general, whether they're work or at home or wherever.
Dennis, if you come back to the point that Shelley made a few minutes ago in relation to how Fortune 500 companies value passion, it's very hard to be passionate if you have that dysfunctional relationship with your direct superior, if I can use that terminology. You know, literally that kind of behavior squeezes the living daylights out of people further down the organization. The other thing, and I think we mentioned the phrase the last time as well, is that, you know, engagement is a fancy word for, you know, treating other people, as we'd say in Dublin, proper, treating other people properly, treating people as proper human beings. And you used a phrase, Dennis, in terms of being there for people. That simply means being present in the moment, whether it is for the people you're working with, whether it is for the people that you would love to be passionate with you And I mean, that's what a great leadership is actually all about, being passionate with a load of other people. Or whether being passionate with your loved ones at home in the evening. There's an awful lot of people go home in the evening or put their laptop down at the way things are at the moment and are still half at work and still half somewhere else and still not there for the people that they claim to love.
Yeah, I think, Willie, one of the ahas I've had with some of the work that I've been doing over the last few years, there's a company in the U.S. called Press Ganey that does primarily patient satisfaction and customer and employee satisfaction for hospitals and healthcare. And they've collected this data over the years, and they have found, and I've seen this in their graphs and charts, a direct correlation that those companies that have achieved higher employee engagement and employee satisfaction also have higher scores in patient and customer satisfaction, that the two go hand in hand. And I don't think it's just a coincidence that, you know, we're getting back to the basic skills of engagement again, whether what you learn on the job and what you receive from your supervisor then gets translated basically into how you interact with your customers as well. And it's been proven and also demonstrated these companies that have these high levels of both customer employee engagement actually have some of the best returns and bottom lines and profits. So all these factors go together. What's interesting is they're not focusing on engagement to make more money. They're focusing on engagement because it supports their values, their mission, and their vision. And this talk that I heard last week mentions that engagement should be a strategic priority for any organization. So often we've got, you know, we want to increase our market share, we want to develop new products, we want to make all these business decisions, but our strategic priorities don't include things that affect our workforce. For example, developing our employees, creating succession plans and career pathways. And Gallup, again, is saying with the millennial group, the baby boomers tended to just suck it up, work for a company for 20, 30 years, and then retire. I mean, I can relate to that. I'm in my 60s, and I've worked for three companies over 30 years. And that, for a millennial, they're lucky to work for, you know, three companies over 5 years because the need for the passion, the need to experience their work more than just a way to make money. You know, I'm here at work, you know, I want to be present. I want to engage with the other human beings around me as well as do something very purposeful that commits to a mission or a vision that goes beyond my personal interest. It almost becomes a cause, is what Gallup is saying. So just throw these ideas out there. I know I've kind of thrown out a lot, but,
I can identify with that, Dennis. I actually, many, many years ago, I left a job because I had an issue with something at work that I was talking to my director about. And he said to me, it's just a job. And I thought, okay, so by the time I've got up, traveled to and from work, because we work long hours, and by the time I take travel, sleep and eating out, it's my life. It's not just a job. And, you know, within 4 or 5 months, I'd left.
Yeah.
I think linked in with that, Liz, as well, is the phrase, it's not personal, it's business. But then the best businesses are personal, the positive way.
Well, the really best businesses do the right things for the right reasons. And money is never the right reason for doing anything. But if you do the right things for the right reasons, the funny thing is that, and Dennis, you'll know this as well, the bottom lines of those companies who have passionate and motivated and engaged employees are far healthier with less effort than the bottom lines of everybody else who's focusing on the bottom line.
And I also think one of the objectives maybe of a company should be to, in a sense, help move people on, because if you're developing people, you know, there's not going to be a place in that company for all those people who are growing and growing ad infinitum.
Right.
And so I think there should be an openness about how, when you're working for a company, it's because for that period of time, your objectives or aspirations overlap. And there could come a time when actually those aspirations begin to diverge because somebody's outlook has changed, or they've grown a bit, or just what they want has changed. And rather than, well, places I've been, there's been this thing about trying to hold people. And I just think if somebody says, I'd like to resign, I just think you should let them, because clearly they've crossed the Rubicon. And it's not that they're disloyal, it's actually what they want has changed and you can't provide that anymore. And it might be inconvenient, but nobody should bear a grudge.
Yeah.
You know, everybody is free to move on and grow. And sometimes that's by going down a different road.
Yeah, it's a very important point, because in hierarchical organizations, obviously, by definition, the shape of the pyramid, there are less opportunities at the top than there are further down the organization. When I started working for myself first, one of my first clients was a well-known drinks maker in Ireland. And I worked individually one-to-one with each of the top team over a period of a couple of years. And during that couple of years, 50% of the top team left. And I said to the chairman, I said, you realize that half the people you've sent to me have left? And he said, well, they obviously realized that there was this divergence in objectives, or that what they wanted, we weren't able to offer them anymore. Isn't it wonderful that we were able to give them the opportunity to realize that and enable them to do it, rather than for the two of us to grudgingly turn up every day to the point where there was actually a breakdown, or we wasted an awful lot of energy in the meantime, not to mention money, of course. Wouldn't it be wonderful if I like your definition, Pat, of a leader. A great leader is somebody who has all the answers at the end of a meeting. Wouldn't it be great at the end of a meeting as well if everybody was passionate about what was decided during the course of the meeting, rather than saying, thanks be to God for that. I'm late for my next meeting now. And that means I was at neither meeting. Wouldn't it be great if people were passionate together?
I took my husband a cup of tea into a prolonged Zoom meeting he was having yesterday and heard a bit of it. And as I walked out, I thought, by guy, and there's 2 hours of his life he's never going to get back again. It was just really...
You know, I think one of the things I tend to observe, in organizations that have figured out kind of the secret of leadership, is that the senior leaders kind of leave their ego at the door when they enter the room. They allow themselves to be vulnerable and not to have to be perfect all the time. And I think that allowing and letting go is, you know, there's a strong need for many leaders to want to feel like they're in control or think they're in control. And I think this whole idea of being in control is kind of an illusion. I think we're influencing, but are we really in control of anything, to be honest? And so if you're trying to influence people, you have to allow them to think for themselves. Mm. And, innovation typically does not occur in companies where fear is in the culture. You know, one of the goals of, a highly innovative company is removing the fear, because if you're fearful or you're risk aversive, you don't want to take a risk, you're never going to speak up and present a new idea, a new concept. So this whole idea of letting go the need to control and allowing people to make mistakes, frankly, so they don't fear, well, if I make a mistake, I'm going to get fired. Yeah. No, it's part of a learning culture. And again, many of the organizations I work with, learning is part of their culture, so that they learn from maybe what didn't go perfectly or what even failed, so that they don't repeat the same actions again and you know, have the same results. And so often we don't step back from our mistakes because we want to deny that we even make mistakes, because we're leaders and we're supposed to be perfect. So, you know, it requires some humility to be able to do that. But frankly, unless you do that, it's hard, I think, to create this kind of a culture that embraces engagement, trust, again, all these values that so often we overlook because we're so focused on doing, achieving, making, you know, success, all these things we've identified to be kind of the end goal, that we forget to focus on the present. And the present is where these interactions really pay off, if you want to put it into business terms, because that's what creates that culture that can allow an organization to be effective or not.
I think you're talking, Dennis, about what I would call enablement. So when I'm creating a team, it's like I need everyone in the room to feel enabled. And it's usually clear that people aren't enabled at the beginning of, you know, a route into a new project. And I think it's one of my jobs to do that. We had a girl who was hired as a fundraiser, who was just like asking what to do the whole time. And after she got through her second Zoom meeting with the team and saw people putting ideas in, she suddenly sort of piped up and said, you know, that sort of character that emerges in the third scene, I think that'd be much better played by a woman. And so it's like, we all kind of like greeted that with open arms, and it just opened the whole kind of like creative, you know, force within everybody up a bit. It enabled people not to feel scared of like coming up with those ideas. And the fact that we embraced it anyway was just a sort of the right decision to make, actually, after we'd sort of like, we didn't do it sort of, oh, you know, let's do it to sort of make her feel happier. It was just the right thing to do, actually. But it needed that little spark.
Yeah.
And enablement is the key often.
Well, certainly the best, when I worked for people before I ran out of potential employers not to work for myself, the best leader I ever worked for made more mistakes. He had more failures than he had successes. The failures were littered all over the place, and the successes were spectacular. And the great thing was, if you made a mistake, I think I probably made more mistakes working for him as well than I have ever made in my career before or since. And it was great, because you picked yourself up and you did something. You took another risk. I think that's you push yourself out there. You took another risk, and when they paid off, the successes were spectacular. It's all about, as you say, Martin, enabling. It's all about not being afraid. Not being afraid to make mistakes in particular. Or at a more personal level, not being afraid of making a fool of yourself.
When I was teaching primary school children, to break the experience that I was having with children who were constantly wanting brothers to run out things, or were so wary of making mistakes, and it was kind of how they arrived at school with. It wasn't something that was an ethos within the school. So it was my daily task to create as many mistakes on, you know, whether it was on, we were doing iPad work, or whether it was the old board or whatever. And, you know, there'd be much hilarity from the children that I'd made a mistake. And I'm saying, it's not a mistake, it's a learning opportunity. So who could now teach me what the answer could possibly be? And it was just that, you know, you haven't failed if you made a mistake. You know, it's getting across that actually the more mistakes you make, the more learning you're doing, because you're moving forward outside of your comfort zone, as opposed to being the person that just wants to get everything right, you know. And by having the mistakes or failures as learning opportunities, sometimes that can completely take you on a totally new path that you haven't even expected at the, you know, the outset. So it is very much ingrained even in an earlier age. And, you know, and unfortunately, sometimes that stays with people right through into adulthood.
Absolutely. I mean, what we learn as children stays with us into adulthood, particularly if we feel bad about ourselves, which would be a failure rather than a learning experience. Yeah.
Sorry, Dennis. No problem. I was going to just add on to that, Willie, you mentioned earlier, but it's this inner chatter that we have where we're judging constantly, not just us as individuals, but whatever, whether we are in a school or business, that judgmentalness is putting these labels of success and failure on what we experience. If we take that more non-judgmental view and just, you know, accept and allow what happens and learn from it, as Shelley, as you mentioned, that creates to me that trust and that openness to take a risk and do some things outside the box that might be considered innovation, rather than just hunkering down and just getting through the day so I can get home without getting yelled at. I have a client here in Tucson, Arizona, where I've been doing some mindfulness coaching, and several years ago, this individual would go out on the manufacturing production floor and cuss out and ream out people for making mistakes in public around the coworkers. And over the last few years, he has changed to where if he has a performance issue or needs to give somebody feedback, it's done in the privacy of his office. It's done calmly. He doesn't raise his voice. And these are kind of these behavioral changes, I think, as we become more aware of the impact and the power that we have as humans or leaders or supervisors. We're the ones that shoot our cultures in the foot. I mean, we're the ones through our own actions and thoughts that are making or breaking that desired culture we're wanting to have. And as this guy has changed, he's become less of a micromanager. He actually thrived on crisis. He'd go in every morning looking for a crisis so he could run out in the, you know, and save the day. And his supervisors were codependent on him to do all the problem solving. I said, hey, Bruce, you need to just step back, get these folks together and let them solve these problems as a team. And that was a real stretch for him at first, because he really liked to get in there and try to control this situation. But it was killing him. It was stressing him out. His health was not in good condition. So, you know, the ramification of that kind of a being the doer and trying to fix everything all the time is, in addition to being disempowering to your people, it takes a toll on your health, your mental well-being. Again, Willie, I'm sure you've seen that a lot in your clients, but it starts with us. It really does start with us.
Well, I've worked with people who have burned out trying to burn out everyone else. That's the simplest way to put it. People whose behavior has been such that it drove everyone to such distraction that it comes straight back at you and you end up burning out yourself. Karma in action. Yeah, you see all kinds of behavior and misbehavior, and you see all kinds of attempts at control and command, which is the old fashioned way. Indeed, the old fashioned way that even leadership theory was taught, command and control. And as you said, Dennis, earlier on, The truth of the matter is we control absolutely nothing at all. Imagine if you were chief executive of Qantas or British Airways or Air France last year, thinking, you know, this time last year, we're still in February last year, thinking your financial projections were wonderful for the year ahead, thinking that you had control over what was going to happen in the year ahead. God, that silenced everyone.
I know that, Willie. But people talking about control. Control is something that is slightly different now if you're going to try and obtain a positive result from it. We're talking about meetings and enablement. A meeting, it doesn't really start at the beginning of the meeting. It starts sometime before it, when there's engagement with the people who are going to be there, so that you have some kind of an understanding of what the meeting is going to be about and what the result of the meeting should be. And also at the end of the meeting, the end of the meeting doesn't stop, because as Martin, as you said, that girl who came up with an idea during the meeting, after the meeting, the engagement with that person is equally important. It's probably more important to say, listen, well done, that was superb, that was a brilliant idea, thanks a million, keep doing that. The what that gives, that really enables and empowers that person to feel that they are part of the team. And talking about control, we do control, the team leader or whoever's managing the meeting, whether it's a chairman, an MD or whatever it is, you control the atmosphere. You don't control the people, but you control the atmosphere in which the discussion and the meeting will take place. So that's just my little bit.
No. I agree with you absolutely, Joe, because effectively, as I said, you control nothing in this world, but there's one thing over which you have absolute control, and that is your own state of mind. And in having absolute control over your own state of mind, you set the tone for everything before, during, and after. The problem with a lot of people in the organizations for which 65% of people, according to that Gallup survey, are working, is that they haven't bothered to take control of their own state of mind. And if you're in that situation, you know, you don't know what wheels are going to come off anywhere. But you're quite right, Joe. You're in control of the atmosphere within which things happen. But that's because you've either turned up or failed to turn up. And if you've turned up, you know, you're enabling people left, right, and center. You don't even need to worry about the engagement with that girl after, you know, Martin's meeting. Because if you're in the zone and if you're in control of your own state of mind, that engagement is going to flow anyway. Mm. Truth of the matter is that a meeting like this meeting is a little piece of time in a continuum. And the stuff going on before, the stuff going on during, the stuff going on after. And yet I've worked with so many organizations who think the meeting starts at the beginning, you have to follow the agenda, and the meeting finishes at the end because there's another meeting coming up where they'll make the same mistakes all over again. And they won't, Shelley, be learning experiences. They'll just be more mistakes.
And I think as well, that's one of the problems today, certainly as my experience of it a few years ago, was that the day turns out into a series of meetings. So the whole life becomes meeting back to back with another meeting. So like you're just going from one meeting to another. Mm-hmm. So like you're not engaged with this meeting, but therefore apart from that, you're not prepared for the next. Or if you are prepared for the next, you're not engaged in this one because you're thinking about the next one. Or you're still thinking about the last one when you come into the next. Like, it's just, you couldn't possibly, in my opinion, you couldn't possibly be engaged in the subject or the meeting if it's going to be continuous one after another for the 8 or 10 hours of the day, meeting after meeting after meeting on different subjects with different people. It just, you think about it, it's crazy. But that's what happens, or at least used to happen a few years ago. I don't know. Maybe it's all changed. Mm-hmm. I doubt it.
Don't think so. I think it's still exactly the same.
Maybe, Willie, if I could come in there, just talking about leaders and pick it up on what Dennis was saying about vulnerabilities. I think that's probably an area that maybe you see a lot. I work with quite a few leaders in terms of coaching, and people are kind of shielding the vulnerabilities, maybe being strong and driven by ego or whatever in leadership positions, which, you know, there's a real folly in that. And the most impressive leaders I've seen are those who have a good mix of humility and that kind of inner confidence. So they're kind of able to hang back in the meeting, like Pat says, and come out with the answers at the end of it. They don't feel the need to be all powerful and all knowledgeable. And they realize the wisdom isn't necessarily always at the top of the organization. So that kind of mix of humility and self-confidence, they're kind of inner strengths, and they seem to buoy you through all kinds of difficulties and get you there in the end. So that would be one thing that I picked up there from Dennis. I just share something with you. Don't know if you saw the CEO of Lucid, the electric vehicle organization in the United States. And they haven't built one car yet. And the CEO is ex-Tesla. And he has just secured $4.5 billion investment in an organization that hasn't built any cars yet. And I think that's just fascinating to watch. And the future might be for guys like him just taking a punt and going for it.
Yeah.
I'm a reminder of that when you talked about the airlines.
Yeah, you've touched on something very important, Brian. If you're comfortable in your own skin, and I think that's the essence of it all at the end of the day. If you're comfortable in your own skin, you don't need to put up any mask. You don't need to wear any armor. You don't need to even say to yourself, I feel vulnerable, because we're all vulnerable anyway. And you don't even need to feel confident, because through your presence, you're exuding what other people might think of as self-confidence. But if you're comfortable in your own skin, you'll take the rough with the smooth, and you'll embrace failure as much as you'll embrace success, because we're actually built to learn from making mistakes. We're built to learn from losing. So if we're winning all the time, or even worse, losing and pretending we're winning all the time, we're in serious difficulties. All right. Do we want to leave it there? We talk about, you know, 40, 45 minutes, 50 minutes. We're up at the 50 minute mark. I don't want to cut it off, though, either. If there is wisdom in the room, because there's plenty of wisdom in this room, I think, at the moment.
I'll just interject. I just want to thank you all for sharing your thoughts and insights, because I think one of the things Willie and I were looking for in these sessions was a forum to share what we've all learned through our life experiences. You know, Willie and I don't have all the answers to every single, well, maybe Willie does, but I know I don't, but there's a lot of experience. I mean, I bet several of you have 20, 30 or more years experience of, you know, working in the business world. And again, this isn't meant to be just a business conversation. This is meant to integrate with our whole life, you know, our relationships, all of our kind of holistically looking at how our lives all fit together. So I know today we focus more on business, but everything we're talking about applies, you know, in all areas of our life, to be honest. Other final thoughts? Anybody you'd like to share?
I just wondered if I could take the opportunity to throw a little curveball in the mix. which is if you are in the understanding of us all being energy and vibrating at various frequencies, etc., then the biggest effect on our energy is astrology. Now, that might seem to be a bit weird, but actually it's the astrology used by billionaires and millionaires, and it has been given a bad reputation. However, there are those of us who knew what was going to happen last year because of the very expert evolutionary astrologers who could relate those energies spot on to experiences of when we had plagues, things like that. Moving forward with businesses as regard astrology and its energies, it is coming into what's called the era of Aquarius, which is going to last for a few thousand years. But the purpose of that is to show that actually future companies, businesses, ways of living on the earth is going to be from a more humanitarian level, and it's going to be more using technology with a more moral value for humans. So therefore there are certain systems that are currently breaking down because of their ethics, and will be over the next 10 or 15 years, such as the big tech companies who their ethics aren't quite in the right place. Other huge companies, you know, Mark Zuckerberg is already selling off most of his shares to purchase land. So he's stepping out, and there's quite a few others that, because they know what's coming as regards the reshaping of industry and businesses towards a more humanitarian and more long-term, many generational focus, rather than just a quick success, a quick profit, and we move on. Regardless of what's done to people or the planet, for example. So I'd just like to throw that little curveball in there.
Why did you wait to throw that curveball until the last minute? I would suggest we actually need to have a conversation on that, because, you know, if somebody said to me 600 years ago that the Earth was round, I would have laughed at them, knowing that, you know, that is just absolute rubbish. If somebody told me that the Earth travels in a direct line through space and time, now I would say to myself, that's absolute rubbish. But that is one of the fundamental findings of Einstein's theories, that heavenly bodies are moving in a straight line through space-time. If somebody told me a few years ago that I would be talking about energy at all, never mind, you know, some of the stuff that you brought, I would say to myself, but I'm an accountant. It's not a curve ball, because we know nothing. You know, as Dennis said earlier on, you know, nobody on this call has all the wisdom. And I know for a fact you were joking about it when you said that I perhaps had all the wisdom. Because the more we know about what's going on, the more we realize that we really haven't a clue what's going on at all. And I would be very interested myself to have a more detailed conversation or exploration of that. I don't know about anybody else, but you will gather, for those of you who know me for a long time will know certainly one thing about me, is that I don't have the closed mind that I was born with.
I think a conversation could go very interesting.
Absolutely, absolutely.
I would agree. Maybe we could pick up with this topic in our next session. I think, Shelley, what you pointed out is becoming very evident with the climate change discussion. I mean, there's a lot of companies over here in Texas in the gas and oil field are just freaking out what's going to happen. That short-term profit thinking versus, are we going to snuff ourselves out as a species on this planet? Because all we're thinking about is profit, and then we're going to end up like Mars, you know, with no water. I mean, it's obvious Mars had flowing rivers and lakes. And I'm curious, whatever happened to Mars? What happened to all that water? Where did it go? Was there, you know, who knows? But this whole idea of a consciousness shift, I think, especially with the coronavirus, has been a real catalyst for people to start thinking in humanitarian terms. Life is more than just getting the paycheck, you know, and feeding the dog. You know, it's, anyways, I propose we pick up with that. If it's okay with you, Willie, other next.
Well, I'm not sure if I can wait a fortnight for that conversation, but certainly, you know, in terms of the consciousness shift that we've now brought up, I mean, as somebody pointed out to me a couple of months ago, and Liz, I think you were on the call, because it was a guy called Ed Towers, one of our focused farmer friends, made the point probably last March, April, that very often people in their lives have these aha moments, like some of the aha moments that we began to experience when we were forced to live with ourselves last March, April, during the first lockdown. And the point Ed made was that the difference between this aha moment and perhaps other aha moments is that we're all having the aha moment more or less at the same time. Pennies are dropping in a way whereby a body of vibration, if I can put it like that, because we're all vibrating energy, a body of vibration is shifting. And we all know from some of the previous writings on tipping points in the way in which people behave or even see the world, that it only takes a certain number of people or a certain shift in energy to move things in a way that we might not, that the logical mind might never anticipate. But the logical mind's a waste of space, really, in many respects. All right. It's 5 p.m. my time. It's 8 in the morning your time, Dennis, or is it 9?
9 over here.
9 a.m. where you are. And most of us, I think, are in on this call on Greenwich Mean Time or British Real Time. Pat O'Donnell is on Pat O'Donnell Time. It's an entirely different thing altogether. All right. Listen, thanks a million. Dennis, thank you in Tucson. Thanks to everybody. Just wonderful to listen, actually. Listen, I look forward to listening more the next time.
Thanks, Willie. See you now. Thanks, Dennis.
Thanks a million.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Thanks. I'll see some of you later, I think.
Yeah. Okay.
All right. Okay. Bye. Bye.